Good morning. So something that I was intimately aware of this morning as I was sitting on my cushion is that none of us would be here today, and even the Buddhas and awakened ancestors would not have existed without their mothers. So I would like to offer this Dharma talk, this Way-Seeking Mind talk, to my mother. And I thought maybe we could start by going around the circle, and if everyone could say their name and something they love about their mother.
Samir Patel is my name. She takes care of me no matter what. She's very caring.
My name is Nirali, and what I love about my mother is small things that most people don't notice, but she notices and makes sure I have them, or sort of offers that care. So, yeah.
Lance, she is a very good cook.
Doug, and my mother is 93 and still works at relationships.
I'm Ravi. Things about my mother, she's a very happy, well-adjusted person who looks happiness, even though she has all kinds of pains and this and that going on in her life. She's a happy creature. She's a wonderful model to follow.
I'm Violet, and I love my mother for her bubbly essence and creativity, and she always cares deeply for how others are feeling.
I'm Christy, and I love my mother for the fact that she was a waitress for almost 40 years, and when she retired, she started taking vacations and learned how to swim and do yoga, and now she's like a 5-year-old.
I'm Nick. One of my mothers, she's very kind and energetic and enthusiastic.
I'm Mike, and my mother was very Irish, and she liked to clean and particularly wash clothes and iron. And she said, after she, I was doing Buddhism, she said, ironing is my form of meditation.
I'm Alan. My mother, she loved me unconditionally, and she inspired me by seeing good things in me.
I'm Sharon, and I will pass on a comment.
I'm Michael. My mother prays for me daily, and I have great gratitude for that devotion.
I'm Elizabeth, and my mom is also a good cook, and she cooks with her whole being, with love, and I can't wait to get her next meal.
My name is Todd, and my mother wasn't a very good cook. But she introduced me to TV dinners.
TV dinners.
So I'm Bree, and my mother was my primary teacher, and it's largely through her influence that I came to do the work that I do today. And what amazes me about her is her capacity to give. Even when she's completely exhausted, she's just like this, like Niagara Falls, it just comes out of her. She just endlessly, her generosity is just amazing. So my story of finding my way, I actually wrote a whole book about my story of finding my way. It was lengthy and painful and detailed. But one of the places that it started was with a character that was introduced to the world through Lucy Maud Montgomery by the name of Anne of Green Gables. Some of you may have heard of her, but she was my early childhood influence. And early on in the book, Anne of Green Gables, there's a poem, The Lady of Shalott, and it begins with, "Willows whiten, aspens quiver, little breezes dusk and shiver. There she weaves by night and day, a magic web with colors gay." And it goes on, and inside this poem, as with all of the enchantment that was characterized by this character, Anne, was this sense of awe, this sense of opening, ever-opening possibility. And so my spirit came alive in the words of this book, and one of the things this character did was she brought life and magic to things. And so when she was first adopted by this spinster couple on Prince Edward Island, when she was being driven home from the train station, she was renaming all these different places. And one of the places she renamed was this lake that was formerly called Barry's Pond. And so when I discovered Jikoji, I knew that I had found my home when I discovered Ellen's Lake. And so in Anne of Green Gables' honor, I renamed that lake the Lake of Shining Waters. So there was this sense of aspiration that started really early for me, this sense of praying every night when I was a little girl, and looking for something more. And when I hit high school, I became a runner. And so I was running and running and running, and on a Christmas Eve when I was 14, something suddenly happened, and my mind kind of collapsed in upon itself. And there was just the snow falling down, and my feet just one after another making their way along Shenamir Road, this old country road that I grew up near. I grew up a couple hours north of Toronto in Ontario, Canada. And so I took that early experience and thought that running was spiritual. And so I continued on this running journey. And then as my body started to change when I was 15, going on 16, that was when the pain came and I wound up with an eating disorder, which was obviously a really harrowing time. And so I went into sort of the what Anne of Green Gables would call the depths of despair, you know. Things were pretty dark, and I couldn't find my way out. And there was a lot of, there was obviously a lot of mental activity, a lot of depression, and I went to therapy for my eating disorder and committed to this path of transformation. And along that journey, my family took a family vacation to Florida. And I'm 17 at this point, and I've just been bathing suit shopping with my parents, and my dad has told me that my body looks better in a full piece than in a bikini right now. My body was gaining the weight back that it had lost in a period of starvation. And so I wound up in a heap on the floor of the cupboard. And he came up from the beach, and one of the only two times I've seen my father cry. Both times it was in relation to my pain. And I just remember him sort of taking his baseball cap off and rubbing his head and saying, "I don't know how to make you happy," you know? And somehow in that series of moments, I was able to find something inside that could better commit to what it could be to be happy. And I went down to the beach in my new full piece, and I was reading this book by Robert Schuller at the time. Robert Schuller's that minister that has that great glass cathedral. They reenact the nativity scene with all of the live donkeys and camels every year at Christmas time. And I was lying on the beach and read this line in the book that said something like, you know, your gift to the world, you know, is sort of God's gift through you. And then just something happened. I was just lying there and this light just opened up in the sky and opened up in my heart. And there was this incredible radiant presence. And that experience gave me faith that there really was something benevolent that was there, that this force of love really existed. And so thereafter, I would go on these runs and I would stare into streams looking for it, because of course the opening happened and then it closed back down, as they do. And I'd be staring into streams, or I'd get up on top of boulders. In Ontario, is a very rocky area. It's called the Canadian Shield, so we had lots of rocks and rock cuts. And I'd get up on these boulders, and I would just sit there looking, you know. And this was before I knew that Buddhism even existed. I was raised Christian, and couldn't find it, you know. But I continued to look and continued to kind of search for it. And life continued on. I continued to get therapy for my eating disorder and find my way through it. And started a campaign for inspiring healthy body image and helping young women to accept themselves and towards a positive construction of identity. And then, although I was in all this therapy, I was still depressed. And so it was when I was about 24 and just kind of beside myself. I was on a homeopathic regime at that time, and all this body memory was kind of spilling out, and was in a lot of emotional pain. And somebody close to me really strongly advised that I go to this Zen center in Ottawa that I would come to know as the White Wind Zen community. And I'll never forget walking through the doors of this Zen center, and immediately everything seemed so austere. It was like so white. And you know, when I was at university, my girlfriends and I, we had goddess circles, you know, and it was juicy, and we would chant and pray and feast, and it was just so alive and bubbly. And this Zen center just seemed like the other end of the spectrum. And I thought, oh, this is so not for me, you know. And then I sat down, as we're taught to do, and I listened to the practice instruction and received some practice interviews and sort of did as I was told to do. And I started to notice when I'd be sitting there that this kind of like horizon would start to open out, you know, on both sides. And there was this sense of expansion. And I started to notice that if I engaged this practice for 30 minutes a day, my day would go differently. And then over time, when I started to sit full day retreats and several day retreats, I started to notice that the momentum of the patterns of thinking and feeling that had led me into the depression, that they started to give way, that they lost their momentum, and that there was something else that was confident and strong underneath. And so I sat and sat and sat. Well, for 5 years I practiced with this community, and then I moved to the West Coast took a little break, explored Advaita Vedanta, actually, because when I first sat down to meditate in California, Gangaji, who's part of Ramana Maharshi's lineage, she actually suddenly was like she was inside my body. And I had several experiences with Gangaji like this. You know, I'd be on another long dark night of the soul when I was 30, and she, you know, came. And it was really beautiful, because when I met her, finally, because I hadn't met her in person before, and she said, "I recognized you immediately. I'm your fairy godmother." So she had had the same experience. And so I formerly lived in Carmel, and I sat with a teacher at the mouth of the valley that was a Ramana Maharshi devotee. And then was moved, both the external circumstances of my life and the internal ones. There was just a sense that left to my own resources, you know, because this sitting group only met once a week, left to my own resources, I was not engaging daily practice. And it was something that I wanted in my life. And since I've arrived at Jikoji, I found the early mornings to be challenging. And I found that there's something really deep and rich and beautiful is happening in my practice experience, and that this is carrying out into my ability to navigate the world. And so there's this sense of beauty. There's often blissful feelings. And there is love. And so that is how I came to be sitting here today. Thank you for listening. Does anyone have any reflections that they'd like to share, or questions or comments?
So, what did you find of your eating disorder? What was it? What was the problem?
That's the million-dollar question. So, well, I think with eating disorders, it's a complex tapestry that weaves the mosaic that creates one. And so for everyone that struggles with one, it's different. In my case, there was a sexual abuse memory from when I was four, from a neighbor with an alcohol problem and three daughters down the road. And so that body memory was lodged inside of me and actually released during a weekend Zen retreat that I sat when I was 27. And just suddenly there was just all of this rage and incredible grief that came out of me. It felt like a waterfall, you know. I thought I was going to put my fist through the wall, you know, and it was just so intense and rigorous, you know. And so that body memory in my case was there. And I think that, you know, when the Buddha talks about conditioned experience being part of the suffering of the world, that, you know, our programming as women, that our worth is to be found in how we look and increasingly in our capacity to self-objectify, that there was a lot of pain in adopting and running that story as I was growing up into a healthy female form. And I also came from a family where there was a lot of emphasis on performance, athletically and academically. And so I was an Olympic hopeful when I was in high school, and I was running hard and being recruited, you know, by the Canadian Olympic coach, and there was all this pressure and there was all this identity around performing athletically, and then there was a lot of identity around performing academically. And so it was interesting because when I moved to the West Coast just before I turned 25, I started to go by my middle name, which is Bree, named after my dad, Brian, because I didn't want to be Lindsay Mathers anymore, because there had been so much this buildup of all this identity around being this star runner in the paper all the time, and I just wanted to let that all go, you know. And so I did. And it's amazing because life has become so abundantly joyful so much of the time, you know, in that release. Yeah. And in terms of moving through it, Zen practice was a huge piece, but there were other pieces, like discovering sort of food sensitivities. That was really vital. That sort of changed my chemistry, you know, and discovering the value of supplementation. And so I was, when I had my eating disorder, I was running in really extreme cold temperatures, hurting my body. I still have a bronchial condition from it. And I know in Chinese medicine, two things are not so hot for your kidneys. One of them is running, and the other one is really cold temperatures. And so there has definitely been some ensuing adrenal fatigue, which is why the early mornings here are difficult sometimes, because my system's just doesn't seem to go down early, naturally. Yeah.
I think you mentioned Advaita practice and Ramana Maharshi's practice. Like, what was the interweaving of that with your Zen practice, or did it bring to light some other aspects of things?
Well, it's interesting because it was such a different practice, because in that tradition there is no practice.
It's a question.
It was just this self-inquiry to look for what is already there and what is changeless. And when I actually did that, that was really rich, you know. But remembering to do that, you know, when life would get in the way, was kind of another story, you know. But I still feel very connected to that tradition, you know, in my art. And that bhakti tradition also still feels very natural to me. Christy?
Hi. This mine's more of a comment. I just wanted to thank you for sharing your story and being so open. And I just wanted to comment that I think it's wonderful that you took your experience and made meaning of it by using it as a way to educate other women, because it is a prevalent problem, as we've talked about before. And I think that takes a level of courage to render it so that it has meaning. And so I just want to applaud you for that. And I hope that you applaud yourself for that, too.
Thank you. Yeah. It's interesting because when I first started speaking, I was so overwhelmed, because I was 18 and 19 when I started presenting. You know, as I was finding my way through the eating disorder, I started doing this activist work, and you know, the girls would come up to me and like their moms wouldn't let them put butter on their toast. You know, I mean, there would be so much pain. Sometimes like 20, 30, 40 girls that would want to come up because they're large presentations. And I didn't know how to handle it when I was 18 and 19, and all it would do is trigger my pain. You know, I mean, I would love them and I would, you know, be gentle, you know. But it really wasn't until I started practicing Zazen that there was more of an ability to meet what was showing up, you know, and not go home and bawl my eyes out, you know, and, you know, there was a different experience of relating to that suffering, you know, and more of an acceptance of it, I think, as well, you know, and then, and also more of a capacity to guide them into a place of possibility, you know. And one of the things I started doing with them as well is, well, I have a follow-up workshop, Love the Skin You're In on the Mat, which teaches yoga and mindfulness practice. But sometimes I would just take these girls, you know, a string of them down to the girls' change room, just line them up along the wall in the shower and just get them to sit down and pay attention. And we would do this mindfulness practice, and they would recount right there in that moment. They would say, oh, wow, you know, it's like they had not considered that their minds might be lying to them or that they're not their thoughts and feelings. And so in some cases it was really meaningful for them. So it's really lovely to have that tool to be able to offer. And now I do it in the whole, now I've implemented mindfulness practice into the whole keynote presentation. So there'll be like 400 or 500 girls sitting up straight, and we just do it for a minute together, because when there's that many, it's tough. But they do it, and they're like, oh, there's a way out. You know what I mean? That this idea that there's something else that can be considered. It's really powerful to be able to share that.
I feel like it goes well with the themes of delusion in Buddhism, because mm-hmm. these standards of beauty are, in my mind, a delusion.
Very much so.
So I can see how those work well together. And I just wanted to mention, just as a positive story, so I have these two friends who, they're both considered, by most measures, wildly attractive people, and they had this wildly attractive child. And everywhere they go, they keep hearing how people keep saying, your daughter's so beautiful, your daughter should model. I mean, you can see it already, she's 4. But they're very self-aware of these issues.
Yeah.
And they have asked people to stop telling their daughter how beautiful she is, mm-hmm. because they do not want that to be what she strives for. So they've asked people to start complimenting her on what she's done.
Yeah.
And so hearing stories like that really makes me feel like, okay, there's more awareness and space around it now.
Yeah, I think that's very conscious parenting. Because mm-hmm. all the studies show now that actually it's between the ages of 3 and 5 that kids have collected their ideas about what's attractive and what's not attractive, and the whole body image thing is basically laid out before they even hit elementary school. So that's wonderful that they're doing that. And it's hard because they're so adorable. These children are so adorable, right? And so that's what comes to mind. And even when you say beautiful, it's like, yeah, physically, but it's the whole thing with kids, you know? But yeah, it's important to be conscientious around it. And who knows what will come either way, because she's still going to get the reinforcement. Yeah. Thank you.
These talks are always interesting, because you have a perception of a person and then you hear their story.
Mm-hmm.
Like my perception of you is that you just kind of dance through life. And all kinds of wonderful adventures, because you're this very, you're this very happy, bubbly kind of person, and then I hear all this story of your struggle, and I know intellectually that no one escapes the First Noble Truth, and we all have to struggle and endure, but it's so surprising, you know, and I think that Krishna is a testament to your inner resilience or your diligent practice, or, you know, the two meeting each other. It's hopeful, I guess, mm-hmm. for, you know, you're a testament that people through diligent practice can, you know, overcome all kinds of bizarre things that fall our way. So it's such haphazard circumstances we seem to land in. Suddenly we're here and we have parents who maybe, you know, was saying good things about their mother, but maybe some not so good. You don't choose it. You just land there. What's your name?
Simi.
Yeah, you beat me to the question I really wanted to ask, because I was introduced to Ramana Maharshi a little bit after I was already very interested in Zen, but by the time I started really practicing Zen, I'd been interested in both. So, and they sort of were interwoven in the beginning, and this, especially since I was in a Rinzai, that question and the who question is very much a part of Rinzai practice as well, and it was a very easy avian, you know. I didn't feel like I was really doing anything different other than, you know, the trappings. And I wonder, I mean, you sort of asked her this, but I guess just a little more, just because I know in Soto Zen, you don't exactly ask a question while you're sitting. I'll still throw that in because it's just when it comes up. But is any of that, you did this like 5 years, right, with Kanjiji?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that in what way it still is there or colors your practice, or is it just now kind of something that you did, and, or do you even know?
No, I mean, I think it's definitely part of, it's been such an intimate part of my journey, you know, and so I think it's definitely there, and sometimes when I'm sitting, see, the Zen school that I came from was quite rigorous, and there was a kind of an intensity to the practice instruction, you know, and so sometimes that could kind of reinforce a certain inner dialogue, you know, and so what I found healing about the Ramana Maharshi path was that I was taught to surrender the thoughts. And there was this kind of, what felt like this feminine grace in that path of just surrender the thoughts, you know. And that movement of surrender, there's a softening quality to it, you know. And I also find that the Zen that's practiced in Koban's lineage here, I call it gentle Zen, you know, because it has that soft quality. And from the first sesshin I sat here when I was just going, getting in every round for the first 3 days, getting no sleep at night because I was sleeping in a room with 6 women and I'm just really sensitive. And Angie looked at me and she said, "Bree, it's not the Olympics." And it was revelatory because I thought, oh, actually there's room to take care inside of, you know, what is a rigorous practice, you know? And so I will say, like, the openings that I had with the really rigorous training were pretty enormous, you know? It was just kind of awesome,
what,
you know?
What lineage?
Well, the teacher's name is Anzen Hoshin Roshi. Well, we were told that it was Soto, but but I've since learned that there may be some Rinzai influence.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe. But then what I'm noticing, you know, when you talk about that self-inquiry that's part of that non-dual path, I found this notion of wonder that we've been exploring is actually, there's a lot of resonance there. And I was noticing in my practice just around the time of us offering that wonder workshop that sense of wonder is that kind of soft surrender, you know? It's feels like the same thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your comments and your questions. Hi.
So thank you for the talk and for sharing the story. And the story is sort of important for me because I've got an 8-year-old daughter. And we were having dinner the other day and she said, I don't want to eat that because I don't want to be fat. She's 8 years old and she must have picked that message up from her. So what I'm hoping to do, and again this comes from things that I've thought about quite a bit, is to get comfortable with multiple identities, and I'm hoping to teach her that through the fact that you can have multiple identities, and somehow the question seems relevant to that. I'm not able to spell out all the facets of the issue, but it's okay to have multiple identities and to learn to be comfortable with all those multiple identities. So it's more of a comment than a question, and I'm asking if you had any thoughts about that.
That's very interesting. Now, when you say multiple identities, can you explain that more?
That you can, there's a part of you that thinks of yourself as a beautiful woman, there's a part of you that thinks of yourself as a scholar, there's a part of you that thinks of yourself as a philosopher, and all these can coexist. That's a lesson that I'm hoping that, not directly, but through example, that I'm able to teach to her, but I need, I guess, some help and role models and to accept the part of the world which sort of looks at a human being and then, you know, sort of ranks them on the beauty scale, or and to have a positive dimension to it, accept it, and it of course has a negative dimension, the sort of experiences many women or people go through and being gazed at and being dragged in some way or the other. I don't know, I'm rambling, I guess, but to have that as just one small component of her life that she accepts, along with so many other things that she is capable of doing and will be doing, even without trying hard.
Yeah.
At any moment that you can be as a human being, all these multiple dimensions, and it's okay sometimes.
That's very wonderful, and I think it's so very, very, I agree with you, it's so important, you know. And I would also, I would start to do some specific stuff with her around that program that she's brought home from school, you know. One of the things you can do is you can sit down with them and just open up a magazine and go through it. You can find some YouTube videos with Photoshop and show them what they're actually doing. And you can start to teach critical media at a really early age before that kind of sets in, because yes, she's actually directly experiencing this fear of fat and, like, associating it with certain foods already. I can give you several more ideas, you know, later if you like. But, yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, it's become a rite of passage, I think, into our culture for most young women now, is this normalization of body hatred, really. And so there's lots of opportunity for growth, you know? I think it's symptomatic of the other malaise that our world is facing, and that symptomatic of the way that the status of women informs the state of our world. Yeah. Even when you look at larger issues like poverty, even poverty is a gender issue. 70% of those living in poverty are women and children, you know. And on the other side of that, the studies show that when women are in positions of power, occupying parliamentary seats and so on, that those cultures, those places in the world, everybody thrives more. There's more caregiving legislations passed, and the whole that whole world thrives. So I think we have a long way to go, you know, with our world. But there's always hope.
Guys get off scot-free.
It's not so, then.
Now we feel a little pain here and there.
I don't think so.
No. I think the same.
Maybe you did.
That seems like, you know, we miss out on the whole, you can't be putting butter on that toast. Or, of course, you know, it's a whole different culture, but it seems like the male culture is, why can't we get into some of that trouble like women have gotten into, and it might actually improve our half of the species?
Mm. I want to respond to that.
Look at, in athletics, see the torture, the chemical and steroids. So have you ever looked at those football players? They're bizarre. This is, in my life, being thin, you have to be like a football player. To you know, there is, I was trying to formulate the question, but there, a lot of the position you have, there, it's a reflection, as you pointed out, of the social implications and directly to the male gender. It may not be as obvious, but I think there's a direct line that is not really discussed as well as a part of it. Also, and because of my art bent, the idea of beauty is one of the great things of art history is they introduce you to the sculpture of Venus of Wallendorf, which is one of the very old primitive fertility goddesses. And you know what this looks like? I think that would be a great introduction for your daughter. Because and also, so there's a lot of that. I was kind of curious whether or not the eating disorders would arise more in older women or in younger women. In my sense, though, I know nothing, it seems as though it would be more in this sexuality in the younger women, where older women and older people and older in general, there is no escape. You are going to lose this great eminent beauty that is causing so much trouble. It's inevitable. As we get older, it evaporates. So I almost want to say embrace it, you know, because it's fleeting.
Anyway. There's so many things I want to respond to in so little time, but I do want to respond to the issue around male programming, because I don't think men get off scot-free at all. I think that they're just as much a part of the system of oppression, you know, the way that little boys are taught that it's not okay to express their feelings, you know, and that they have to sort of shut down at that early stage of life, and then just the reinforcement of identity around power over and having to be the stronger one and the tougher one. I think that although the whole body image piece is increasing with boys, and it's increasing in women over 40, there's like a 41% increase in eating disorders in women over 40, but at the same time it's increasing in young people. So between 96 and 2006, there was 119% increase in hospitalizations for girls under 12 for eating disorders. So it's sort of across the board happening. And I think it's important that we see beauty as being free of, well, for lack of better terminology, being free of the way that patriarchy would define it, you know, and that we need to take beauty back, you know, and allow it to be wild and free and unregimented and three-dimensional and variegated. So I'd just like to close by reading the last paragraph of my book, because it brings me some peace, you know. In the driveway that snakes... Okay, so Higgins is my golden retriever, the reference to Higgins, and Brandy Lake is the lake I grew up on. In the driveway that snakes between Brandy Lake and Brackenridge Road, I slip from the vehicle, whistle for Higgins, who still feels me although his hearing is long vanished, and take to country roads. Along the home stretch that held my strides for so many years, trees reach victorious, 1,000 arms etched against the flame burning rose soft in a western sky. And the moon hangs, a silver teardrop resting on twilight's breast, softly singing me beyond, beyond the pain, beyond the violence upturned by peace, beyond my footsteps and my words. Take me home, I whisper to the Muskoka roads long since memorized by the soles of my feet.